From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. For years, there's been an achievement gap that existed between poor and English learner students and their classmates. This is a particularly pressing issue in California, since these high-risk students represent nearly 60% of the state's 6 million K-12 students. In urban school districts like Fresno Unified, that number jumps to more than 85%. Recently, Governor Brown has proposed, and the legislature has adopted, a new way to fund K-12 education in the state, called the Local Control Funding Formula, that will provide school districts with supplemental funding to help close this achievement gap. We'll examine the details of the program and the prospects for success with Rachel Ehlers, a specialist in school finance with the nonpartisan California Legislative Analyst Office, Alisa Wynn, the State Board of Education's expert on the Local Control Funding Formula, and John Fensterwald, a reporter with EdSource Today, the leading source of news and analysis for K-12 education issues in California. We'll also hear from Central Unified Superintendent Mike Berg, Mary Jane Skellerup, the Senior Director of Programs with the Youth Leadership Institute, Ruth Kinto, Fresno Unified Deputy Superintendent and CFO, and Eva Ruiz, President of the Fresno Teachers Association. The Local Control Funding Formula, the devil's in the details.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From Fresno, the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
In the last year, the California legislature, at the governor's urging, made some major changes in the way the state funds local schools, referred to as the Local Control Funding Formula. What is the Local Control Funding Formula, and how does it work? We're joined by Rachel Ehlers, the specialist in school finance with the nonpartisan California Legislative Analyst Office. Welcome back to the Maddie Report, Rachel.
Thanks for having me again.
The basic components of the Local Control Funding Formula, what are they, and how does it differ from the way schools have been financed in the past?
Well, you know, it's a pretty simple formula. There's a base grant that's given for every pupil in the state. It varies a little bit based on age, but this base grant. And then there are a few additional supplemental grants. The largest is a 20% extra, 20% of that base grant for students who are either English learners or from low-income families. There's also some additional funds provided for kindergarten through third graders for smaller class sizes and for high schoolers for career technical education. And then districts that have really large concentrations, more than 55% of these English learners and low-income students also get some additional funding. I'd say there are, you know, two real primary differences from the way we used to give money to schools. The first is that it's much more transparent, easy to understand, rational.
Which is not the Winchester Mystery House.
Quite different from the way we used to do it. And then the second is that it really is focused on local control. There are a lot fewer restrictions and requirements coming from the states. Local school districts have a lot more discretion how to spend these funds.
It's also obviously targeted on high-need students. So here's the question. Pie is finite, right? So if one school gets more money because they have more high-need students, does that mean another school district gets less?
Well, no district will get less than they got last year, which was when this all rolled out. Mm-hmm. So there was sort of a floor set. And also no district will get less than they got before the recession. The built into the formula is the assurance that generally all districts will get what they got before the recent budget cuts with some cost of living adjustments. But you're right. One district may get less than their neighbor district, and that's really by design. Everybody's playing by the same rules now.
They're all districts are getting more, is what you're saying, but some are getting a little more.
That's right, based on their student needs, not based on historical funding formulas. That's the key difference.
Okay, so how much is all this going to cost?
Well, in the governor's budget proposal that came out in January, he's proposing $45 billion for this coming year. To fully implement the formula would cost $55 billion, so an additional $10 billion, which is roughly 10% of our overall state budget. But the state doesn't have resources to fully implement it now. The plan is that it will be rolled out over time.
But is this new money, or is this in addition to what they've received in the past?
This is including money they've received in the past. The formula is really built to use the existing Proposition 98, our state constitutional requirement for how much we have to give schools. So it's not supposed to cost the state more than we otherwise would spend. It's really making sure that it's distributed more fairly.
I assume that, you know, there's a saying that he who has the gold makes the rules. So I assume that the money comes with some strings attached. What are they?
Well, as I mentioned, there are many fewer restrictions. Those that have the gold are giving more discretion to locals. But there are, you're right, some requirements. I think really the primary one is that this additional funding that districts are getting for their low-income and English learner students, that 20% more, districts have to show that they're using those funds to increase or improve services for the students that generate the funds. Now, the State Board of Education has recently adopted some regulations guiding districts exactly how that will work, and I think you're talking about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this local control accountability plan. Supposed to improve transparency and accountability. What exactly is that?
So the Local Control Accountability Plan, which we are referring to as LCAP.
It's easier.
it's almost like a strategic plan for districts. They have to identify goals in 8 state priority areas, and these priority areas are things like student achievement, student outcomes, parent involvement. So they have to identify their goals. They have to say what actions they're going to take to make progress on these goals and what expenditures they're going to make for those goals. And then they have to detail what kind of progress they're making, look at student data. And there's a requirement that parents be involved in developing these plans and that they be public documents.
What happens if a school district's having a problem meeting the performance expectations that the state's set out?
Yeah, so the legislation also sets out some parameters for providing some additional technical assistance to districts that are struggling, and districts that struggle for several years will have even more intensive state intervention. But the details of exactly how that is going to work are still kind of being figured out at this point. There's a framework set in place, but the State Board is working on putting together some evaluation rubrics.
We're now joined by the project manager who's responsible for the rollout of the local control funding formula, Elisa Nguyen with the State Board of Education. Well, welcome to the Matter Report, Elisa.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, a big concern that's been expressed by some is that the extra money that districts are going to receive really aren't going to be targeted to high-need students, but instead are going to be spent on these district-wide initiatives, things like general salary increases. How can you convince folks, or what can you say to folks to assure them that that's not going to happen?
Sure, and this is an important question. We really heard a lot of comments on this theme at our state board meeting in January where the regulations were adopted, so it's important to talk about it. The regulations do allow for some district-wide, school-wide expenditures. They also require in a district's local control and accountability plan that a district explain how those district-wide expenditures are meeting the needs of the students, particularly the targeted students, the English learners, low income, and foster youth. A lot of the comments we heard really posed a tension between local control and equity for students, and we'd say these aren't mutually exclusive. These are something that should be thought about together. You know, there's local control for districts overspending, but that goes hand in hand with accountability.
But people do, when they describe this issue, they seem to do say that these are either-or situations.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we also heard at that state board meeting from a lot of districts and what they're doing with their local communities, and we've also talked to a lot around the state, you know, and in different settings about what they're doing, and you know, really, they're taking this very seriously. They're working with their local community, and they're answering to their local communities as they come up with, you know, what they need to do. You know, the local control funding formula at the heart of it really makes local accountability as important as state accountability, if not more so.
Well, I'm going to ask about this issue about proportionality.
Sure.
It's one of these words you see in state politics that comes up every once in a while. But this is the idea that districts have to use this extra money to, quote, increase or improve English learner or low-income pupils' services to those pupils in proportion to the increase in supplemental and concentrated funds, unquote. How do the regulations make that happen?
Sure. So the regulations, the expenditure piece of the regulations adopted in January, establish a minimum proportionality percentage. And what this really is it says how much more must you do for your low-income English learner and foster youth students that's above and beyond what you generally do for all students. And the regulations themselves contain a formula that basically takes the additional funding you're getting for those students and compares it to the base funding you're getting to get you that percentage.
You know, one of the arguments by some of the critics of this is they're saying, you know, you shouldn't limit proportionality to that extra money, but instead it should be applied to the entire base. Otherwise, you're just using that extra money just to provide basic services for these high-need students. What do you think? Should proportionality also be applied to the base funding?
Sure. So, you know, we really discussed this in depth, and really last summer when we started engaging with stakeholders around this, this was the big issue. The way the regulations are designed, you're comparing the additional things you're doing for those low-income English learner and foster youth students to what you're doing generally for all students. So you are comparing it against, you know, kind of a your common base services.
So these are like the add-on services that you're, mm-hmm. that you're targeting to these high-need students.
Right.
Do more services mean the same thing as spending more money?
No. You know, if that were the case, this would just be a spend more regulation. You know, in general, really, you know, when the local control funding formula comes in, it balances giving, you know, additional local control to folks, but also ask them to complete these local control and accountability plans where they'd say, what are the outcomes we're going to achieve for our students and how are we going to reach our goals around those outcomes? So they shouldn't be just thinking about how they're going to spend additional dollars. They should think about the dollars they already have and the services they already provide. This isn't just quantity, but really the quality of service.
I want to ask you about that local control accountability plan. It was due in, was supposed to be due in March, on March 31st, but you guys got it out 3 months early in January. Why did you get it done 3 months early, and what have been the key issues?
Sure. Our state board members, you know, really felt strongly as we had meetings up to that January meeting that they wanted the template, the local control and accountability plan template, to come along at the same time. One is that, you know, districts will be doing this for the 14-15 year, and they're doing their budget planning really starting in January. So having this as a tool that can move with their budget was important. The other issue is the local control and accountability plan is so linked to the expenditure regs. That's where the districts are going to support and explain how they're meeting that proportionality percentage. So having these things move together, it just made sense.
To get it done early because they've got to do planning.
Right.
So you got to wonder who came up with the March 31st deadline. Be that as it may. One last question, and that is, in 2015, the State Board of Education is supposed to adopt three rubrics to assess district performance. Where are you in that process? Can you tell us what the issues are that are being considered?
Sure. So, you know, I don't have a whole lot of detailed information. We're really in the initial planning stages. We have until October 1st, 2015 to adopt rubrics that basically allow for local evaluation to help identify school districts that need technical assistance or that need additional supports. You know, as we're still designing this process, I think the one thing that, you know, the state board has asked us to do and that staff are really looking forward to is the engagement we had with stakeholders. We had so much engagement that made the regulations we've adopted thus far much better than what we originally proposed, and we want to carry that through, that same process through on the regs, on the evaluation rubrics. And then the other piece is that we also are looking forward to the feedback we're going to get from the LCAP implementation process this first round, and that will feed into the regulations for evaluation.
I want to thank Alisa Wynn with the State Board of Education for joining us. We're now talking with John Fensterwald, who's a reporter with EdSource Today, one of California's most respected sources for education information research and analysis. Welcome back to the Matter Report.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You know, school districts are supposed to get parental and community involvement, input into how they're going to be spending this extra money for high-need students. What's happening in that regard? Are they doing it?
Yeah, I think it will. It's still a bit early in the process. The new budgets with these plans and that call upon community parental and student involvement need to be approved by July 1st. So it's still a little bit early. The regulations that the state board passed in January, but so I think you're going to hear a mixture of some districts are embracing it fully and actually began the input process before the regs were passed, knowing they were coming. Other districts have waited until January and now are beginning the process. So it's sort of all over the place, and we'll see. But some are actually embracing this opportunity.
Are they setting up parental advisory groups, for example, mm-hmm. To kind of make sure this input actually occurs and is heard by the school board?
Right, but by law they must. They must approve, each district must approve a parent advisory council.
But do they have to create a new one, or can they use an existing council?
That's a good question. Many of them have a budget committees, and what they should be doing, though, is reaching out and creating a new prayer and advisory committee. Perhaps they may rename it. I'm not exactly sure, actually, what's going on. The intent, though, in one way or another, is to have community and parent involvement and students as well from not only your usual suspects, too, who show up at hearings, but actually to do a lot of outreach in the community and bring in folks who aren't necessarily or have not been involved in the process.
This thing is called the LCAP, which is the plan that's due out in July, on July 1.
Right.
Are you hearing a lot of input or voices from community groups that they want to have a say into how that LCAP actually turns out? What are you hearing out there?
I think one of the unanswered questions is to what extent are parents become aware and get involved in this?
Are they very aware at this point?
I think when EdSource did a survey, there were very few folks knew about the local control funding formula, and implied by that, they didn't know what LCAP is either. I think that districts really need to do a lot of outreach to explain to parents what this is involved. One of the issues, there are statewide nonprofit groups that have been involved in this area and pushed for the law. But keep in mind, we're heading out from Sacramento, where they had a lot of sway, out into 1,000 districts. And so these groups aren't necessarily organized in all of these, you know, the key districts, Oakland, Los Angeles, Sacramento, what's going on, and Fresno, of course. Mm-hmm. But what's going on beyond that, we're not sure.
Okay. It sounds like some of the folks, though, on the one side, want to be very specific about how that money for high-risk students is going to be spent. Almost going back to the issue of categoricals, those pots of money that were for specific things. Well, that's the opposite, it would seem to be, of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you bring those two things together? Do the critics really want this money earmarked for specific things for high-risk students?
Yeah, of course, there's a range of critics. I think there's a recognition, a consensus, really, that you don't want to go back to the categoricals with the paperwork and the requirements of reporting to the state. This is a new system. There is going to be creative tension or tension between the local control part of this funding and the funding formula itself, which guarantees money, more money for low-income children and English learners and foster kids. So there is this tension, but I think what the civil rights groups want is to ensure that the money is spent. The money that's been earmarked for them is actually spent improving their education on services and programs.
What's their big fear?
I think one of the fears is that this money may be bargained away at the table to contracts. And another fear is that the school board may not be listening to these communities and may go out and buy computers, or it may disappear in the district office. And so part of the state board in creating the regulations for this did a dance. It really didn't want to be prescriptive in terms of dictating so that when you have a district advisory committee, you must do this in three languages. You must hold it at night. You must involve certain parents. Instead, the regulations are posed as guidelines and questions. Have you made an outreach into your community? Did you translate it into languages that all parents can understand? Did you provide childcare? It's posed as questions and guidelines to encourage districts. So whether it works or not, we'll see in over the next year.
Well, look, the governor said that this new money per the LCAP, quote, the goals of equity and flexibility are not exclusive. He thinks it can happen. Can it happen?
I think the governor really believes that. But the governor it made it clear all along. The governors believe that there needs to be more funding for these children. Very clear. But at the same time, the governor has believed in sending this money to the district, not to each school, so the school boards will make the decisions as to how the money will be spent. This is not a voucher system where we give each child this money and the money must be spent on that specific child. The decisions will be made at the district, and the governor is very clear that that's where the decisions will be made.
We're talking with John Fensterwald with EdSource today. According to education experts that you talk to, do they think this new targeted money is going to actually close the achievement gap between Black and Hispanic students and their Asian and white counterparts?
Well, that certainly is the hope, and it's, of course, been the hope in California for many years. One of the interesting things about this system is that we're going to be measuring schools not just by test scores, but the local control funding formula set 8 priorities, and they include school climate, they include access to courses, they include how are you implementing the Common Core. So, and test scores are just one of these priorities, so that we're hoping to achieve to close the achievement gap by not just focusing on scores, but to focus on the environment in schools and districts, and how are you reaching out to students in other ways so that that will ultimately close the achievement
gap. When you talk about some of those categories, though, they sound somewhat subjective. School climate.
Yes.
How do you give an objective number to school climate?
That's one of the big challenges that the state board and districts will have to look at. I mean, that really is. And in fact, the state board has several years to come up with a so-called rubric that you can actually evaluate a school and evaluate a district. So how do you, for example, districts understand that a state of mind, a child's state of mind, is really important to their learning process, grit and determination and perseverance, right? It's not just important just to drill and kill and teach these kids. It's what's your state of mind? How do you problem solve? Are they critically thinking? So some of these can be measured by standardized tests, problem solving, critical thinking perhaps. But determination and perseverance, the kinds of skills which will get you into college, that is subjective. It's also very important to look at. So whether or not we have a scale which says a school gets 65, mm-hmm. or whether or not we present to parents, here are the areas that your school is doing well. You can look at your test scores, mm-hmm. but in terms of parent involvement, no, it needs improvement. Do your children feel comfortable and safe in your school, which is a precursor to learning? That's another way. And so you'll evaluate schools on several metrics, and it will be more complex than we've done it before.
It sounds like it. Are educational experts, do they agree on the best practices to close that achievement gap?
I think that there are some, there's some agreement. I mean, but we know how to raise test scores. I mean, but how do you deal with the broader things that we just talked about? That's more difficult. We do know that it all starts with a good, well-qualified, skillful teacher. Okay, that starts, and then we need collaboration from there. There are some things that only resources. We know we need counselors. Pre-kindergarten, preschool helps.
You're hearing a lot about universal pre-K.
Yes.
These days.
Yeah.
Is some of this money, could it be used for that?
It can be used if the district chooses to make this a priority. There's also an initiative in the legislature to extend to have a two-year kindergarten, and that would require separate funding. But there's recognition. I think one of the things that we're recognizing is that there are a lot of factors that go into school improvement and student growth, and we've, over the past 5 years in a recession, we've neglected many things because we've cut back.
You know, one of the things you talk about a lot is class size. People
right.
seem to think that really makes a difference. And so I've read that the magical number seems to be 24 that people want to focus on, keep a class size to that number. But is there any data to support that assumption that a class size of 24 is somehow inherently better than a class size of 25 or 30?
Well, keep in mind it used to be 20. And 24, and we've gotten away from that through the recession, so very few districts have kept 20 to 1 in early grades. Some of them are up to 30 to 1. We you know, the data on small classes is that everyone cites is done for much smaller classes, and 24 smaller than 15 is the primary study. So, no, there's no magic number, but we do know that with Common Core and the kinds of small group work and collaboration and writing and teamwork, that requires smaller rather than larger classes. And in California, we've gotten away from that. We're up to 30, 35. We do know that that's not good. So at least 24 is a line.
So somewhere in between those numbers.
And that's the law, by the way, not just, that is the law under local control funding formula. In 8 years, you need to be at 24.
24, right. There's a new agency, the California Collaborative for Educational Excellence. Do we need it? I mean, we've got the Superintendent for Public Instruction, we've got the State Department of Education, we've got the State Board of Education. Do we really need another agency?
I think the feeling was, and the key word is collaborative. I mean, and that's an unusual word when it's different from under No Child Left Behind, when it was a top-down penalties and you had to do very prescriptive solutions to your problems. There was a deliberate attempt not to give it, frankly, to the California Department of Education because they were very prescriptive and in terms of enforcing the laws. They wanted to create a collaborative that works with low-performing schools and tries to work with them and as opposed to dictate.
I've only got 30 seconds left mm-hmm. in the segment. I wanted to ask you about unintended consequences. Do you see any?
I think one of the, well, it's a new system, it's evolving. Of course there will be unintended consequences. One of the questions we need to know is, did parental involvement and student involvement work? That's a core assumption in the system. One of the interesting things to me will be to see, as parents who do get involved in this, and they have to see the real choices that schools make, counselors, Saturday programs, arts, will they recognize that we're resource shy in California, and having gone through the exercise themselves, did they come to the conclusion that maybe we need more money?
Need more resources. That would be an unintended consequence. Well, I want to thank John Fensterwald with EdSource today. I also want to thank Rachel Ellers with the California Legislative Analyst's Office and Lisa Wynn with the State Department of Education. Up next, what are the implications of this new funding formula for Valley schools? We'll talk to Ruth Kinto, Fresno Unified's Deputy Superintendent and CFO, Eva Ruiz, the President of the Fresno Teachers Association, Mary Jane Skellerup, Senior Director of Programs at the Youth Leadership Institute, and Mike Berg, Superintendent of Central Unified.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. How are local school districts planning to spend this new money that is targeted to those who need it most, economically disadvantaged and English as second learner students? Our guests are all focused on making sure that this spending translates into significant improvements in the performance of Valley schools. They are Ruth Kinto, the Deputy Superintendent for the Fresno Unified School District, Eva Ruiz, the President of the Fresno Teachers Association, Mary Jane Skellerup, the Senior Director of Programs at the Youth Leadership Institute, and Mike Berg, Central Unified Superintendent. Welcome all of you to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
Thank you for having us.
Delighted. Ruth, let's start with you at Fresno Unified. Let's get specific. How much more money is Fresno Unified going to see for your English learner, low-income students under this new formula?
Well, Ken, as you know, we have a very high concentrated poverty in Fresno Unified School District. And as well, we also serve quite a few English learners and foster youth. We estimate that for the current year, we'll receive $13 million over our budgeted revenues for this school year. And then for next year, that we'll receive $58 million over our budgeted revenues. So, yes, it's quite significant resource for us.
What about, Mike, what about at Central Unified? What are you guys going to see?
We're seeing about the same numbers on scale. We're about a fifth the size of Fresno Unified, and so we're seeing about a 7% increase over the 2 years, $7.5 to $8 million.
Boy, after all those years of getting of cuts and state cuts, this must be pretty good news.
It's terrific news, and the way it's delivered, it gives us some great flexibility to deal with the populations that are most needy.
You know, Eva, you know, you represent the Fresno Teachers Association. You know, the state's eliminated most of this thing called categoricals, where state money is tied to specific programs or activities. Instead, the state's giving districts more flexibility in how it spends its money, including how it spends this extra money for English learner and low-income students. Do you, as president of the Fresno Teachers Association, think the flexibility the state is providing school districts is too much, too little, or just right?
No, we believe it. It's just right. It provides many options to address the students of poverty and English language learners, including class size and materials necessary to address the learning needs of all these students. So we're very pleased with it.
Mike, what do you think?
I would agree. I think it's a great opportunity for us to address the needs of those most needy, those that were identified, the EL students, the economically disadvantaged students, as well as the foster and group home kids. We have a very high percentage of students who are without parents and are with guardians and need a great deal of service as well. You know, the other thing that's good about Fresno County schools, including Fresno Unified, is we did not make the reductions that many districts in the state did over the past several years. And so this is really providing us an opportunity to enhance some of the most effective programs. And I think that flexibility locally will allow us to do so.
Well, Mary Jane, you're not really in part of the teaching bureaucracy or education bureaucracy. You're with the Youth Leadership Institute. What are your thoughts in terms of the flexibility that districts are being given?
Yeah. So for those of us who are kind of on the outside looking in at the Youth Leadership Institute, we work a lot with students and also we're other CBOs who are trying to help ensure that our young people are being prepared for a career in college. really, with local control, we're really talking about local accountability as well. So in this way, districts really control the data, specifically relating to how our students are doing in real time. So I think that with local control equals local responsibility. And I do think that that burden of responsibility really does begin to rely and sit with the districts. They need to be able to get the truth about how these key subgroups are doing into the hands of teachers, parents, students themselves, and community organizations so that we can all work together to ensure that these dollars are being well invested in interventions that actually work for our English learners, for our young people who are on free and reduced lunch, and for our foster youth. So that's a really critical way. Really, it's up to the districts to provide that information, and the rest of us will work to ensure that this is actually helping those students.
It sounds like, Ruth, it sounds like we've got a consensus here. At Fresno Unified, are you pleased with the flexibility you've been given?
We are pleased with the ability to utilize the resources in a way that applies to the unique circumstances of our district as well as respectively to other districts in the state. And, you know, the way that we approach our budget development has always been one of transparency, and community involvement. And so this is just a perfect opportunity for us to continue the outreach and continue the implementation of programs that are going to be most effective, as Mary Jane said, to increase achievement for our students, particularly those that are in need.
You know, Mary Jane, with the Youth Leadership Institute, what are your thoughts on the state's template for this local control accountability plan that each district has to develop? What are your thoughts on that? Is it a good idea, a good template?
Well, theoretically, I think the way that it's set up is it's a good template. They made some key changes towards the end of the year that I think help ensure a little bit more engagement and a little bit more focus on kind of really helping these particular students and ensuring that the money actually follows our English learners, our free and reduced lunch students, and our foster youth with them to their specific school sites. So I think that those things are really important. But I do feel that what we really need to do is make sure that the districts are providing those opportunities for not just parents and community groups, but really students themselves as well, particularly these subgroups of students. I think they have that learned experience of their real lives that can be really valuable to helping us figure out exactly what it is that they need to be more successful in school. As adults, we tend to make a lot of assumptions about what students are going through, and it really helps to hear it straight from the horse's mouth, and that way we can design those things around that. But I do think that, and we are working with Fresno Unified to help make sure that they are hearing from those students and those families, the parents as well, to ensure that they're finding out the real solutions that might be helpful for those students. So I do think they can do a better job, but we're gonna work to help them out with that.
Okay. Well, Mike, they're going to help you to make sure you do a good job, maybe over there in Central Unified. What are your thoughts on this plan? Your plan is due, I guess, July 1, right?
That's correct. Prior to July 1, we must adopt a budget by June 30. And so all districts are looking at that template. First off, it's a good guideline, but hopefully not to create false hope for citizens who think it's the only way to go about it. It is certainly a guideline that will ensure that we engage our community, that we speak with fidelity to what the community articulates as their needs, but also that we address our community's specific needs, because every community, while similar, can be very different. Spoke to our group home, a high percentage. That's a very specific need in Central, and we know we need to address that. But I think it's a great idea to have the template, because certainly it's a sophistication issue also with a number of very small districts that don't have the outreach mechanism that those of us that have the larger districts and the larger outreach protocol in place.
Ruth, what about Fresno Unified? Do you like that template that the state's come up with? And are you ready to do your own plan before July 1?
We absolutely will follow the template. We do believe that it covers all of the bases necessary, and we particularly appreciate the fact that it is going to incorporate the school site plans, the plans for student achievement that are respective to each school. But yes, we are satisfied that it does an adequate job of making sure that the resources are adequately distributed and that they reach the right populations. And at the same time, we do believe that it provides the ability, as Mike Berg said, to meet the needs that are unique and the circumstances that are unique to each respective district in the state.
You know, Eva, with the Fresno Teachers Association, you know, the various educational stakeholders are supposed to have input on how this money is spent. Do you think teachers have been heard in the process?
Well, I think at this time, we don't think there's been a big concerted effort to get the teacher voice in this process. But We are hopeful that we have put in a request to be at the table to discuss, to be a part of the LCAP planning committee, so that we get the teacher voice and the teacher perspective coming from those who directly work with the students, who directly are there for the students. So we're hopeful that we will have a seat at the table so that we can get, like Mary Jane has said, real information to get the good programs continuing and to get good programs coming to our district.
Well, Mary Jane, with the Youth Leadership Institute, what do you think? Do you think the community's been heard or is being heard throughout this process?
Well, I think that there's some key provisions in the LCAP template that help us really kind of look at the key components related to student engagement and making sure that our students are connected to programs, I think, is something that young people and parents especially have really been looking for. So we're looking to hopefully see that really present itself as these plans are fully developed. And also related to school climate, we know that we need to do more to help make sure that we're keeping our young people in school and that our discipline systems make sense and actually help young people learn appropriate behaviors and help their families get them back in school and connected to school. So I do think that there are certain elements kind of related to the way that the plan is forming up. However, I do think that we can always do better at particularly engaging students and parents from English language communities and the low-income communities and particularly our foster youth, which is really a difficult population to connect with because, again, you don't always have those active parents in their lives. So really trying to put a lot of effort into meeting them where they're at and kind of coming out from within the school and district walls and going out into those communities to really engage them, I think, is important. And I do think that we can do a better job of that overall as a community on both the sides of the district and community partners reaching out and creating those opportunities. And that's what we're committed to do in the next couple of weeks to make sure that we get that input.
Well, Mike, at Central Unified, what are you doing to reach out to these various stakeholders, teachers, parents, students? What are you doing?
You make a good point, Mark, and relative to the last question, I don't think anybody's been adequately heard yet because this template was just adopted not long ago, within the last month or so. Many, in fact, all districts have really put together that plan to outreach. And so those, as we see it, six stakeholder groups, which are students, teachers, parents, classified support staff, administration, and community groups and business groups, all need to be heard. So we have a very specific plan that starts in March and covers all of March and all of April. It's over 40 meetings where we're going to outreach and have an open conversation at different venues for each of the specific groups, because we do also believe to have a singular voice, just teachers, just parents, just students, will be rich to make sure we hear their voice and not muddy that with another group. So we have those meetings planned all through March, April. We have meetings planned subsequent to that to aggregate the data that we receive, the input that we receive, so that then we can incorporate all of that into a robust budget development process at the end.
Ruth, what about Fresno Unified? Are you, for example, creating new parent advisory groups? How are you getting input from these various stakeholders?
Right. Well, all of the details of our local control accountability plan are available on our website, including a detailed schedule of the dozens of meetings that we are holding as well. I would just say ditto to what Mike Berg said regarding outreach in the stakeholder groups and getting out into the community. And we have dozens of meetings that have already taken place and that will continue to take place. We actually started at in December with our outreach plan. And so anyone in the, who's listening can go to our website and see a schedule of those meetings and the locations. I'd also like to say that in particular regarding Eva's response on teacher involvement, we actually already have a district advisory council, which is made up of parents, teachers, community members, and we actually have 11 teachers that are represented on the District Advisory Council already, and they are a key component, a key outreach group that we're required to go out to and have already, and will continue to go out to and hear from. You know, just a few days ago, FT FTA requested to, as Eva said, bring this to the table. We don't believe that it's a bargaining issue per se, but we do believe that the outreach and important feedback is needed in order to be influenced as we continue with our other community meetings and continue with the budget development process, as Mr. Burke mentioned. So we have outreach to them several times. They chose to ask for a different committee and to be at a table, and we consider that maybe a bargaining request. So I don't think we're exactly on the same page there.
Okay, well, we're not going to engage in collective bargaining on the program. So let me ask Eva. What do you see, though, generally as the key areas, maybe perhaps, of disagreement, and how do you think those issues are going to be resolved?
Well, I think. Because of the money that's coming in for this base grant allocation means that there's going to be a lot of money coming in to help our students, even the playing field with other counterparts in other districts. Over the 8 years of implementation, I think that that's going to be equalized so that all the districts are starting at the same place. Now, we would like a seat at the table as far as the local control accountability plan. We would like to be there as a representative of the teachers to have input and say from what's coming from our teachers and what needs to be, where it needs to be spent and what programs are working and what programs are not working. So I think that right now this is the beginning of a excellent program, and what we need is a seat at the table to have some real input.
All right, well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the dramatic change in the way the state finances K-12 education. Is it actually going to improve educational outcomes in the Valley? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the local control funding formula, a dramatic shift in the way school districts are going to be financed by the state and its impact on Valley schools with Eva Ruiz, the president of the Fresno Teachers Association, Mary Jane Skellerup, the senior director of programs at the Youth Leadership Institute, Mike Berg, Central Unified Superintendent, and Ruth Kinto, the Deputy Superintendent and Chief Financial Officer for Fresno Unified. So, Ruth, let me ask you, do you think that this new local control funding formula is an improvement over the way K-12 education has been funded in the past?
Absolutely. The former system of state finances in the state of California was antiquated, overly complex, and frankly was ill-served our students in a terrible way regarding the hundreds of categorical programs, the variety of different ways that resources were delivered to districts and then to students. And we do believe that the local control funding formula stops those unnecessary bureaucratic processes and streamlines resources and frankly increases resources to the students who are in most need.
So Eva, are we going to find some agreement here between Fresno Unified and Fresno teachers about this new formula?
Absolutely. It's definitely an improvement, and finally there will be financial recognition for the challenges that districts and educators face when educating students of poverty and English language learners and those that are in foster care.
Yeah, you know, Mike Berg with Central Unified, you know, a lot of categoricals were part of the old formula where money was specifically set aside for specific programs. It would seem that each of those programs would have a constituency. Is this an improvement, giving more flexibility with this new formula, or is it, what are your thoughts on it?
There are really two different schools of thought. My particular school of thought is that districts do have the maximum flexibility now to address the specific needs, unique needs of their district. But very honestly, for the last 4 years, school districts, local governing boards have had the flexibility to pass a resolution to relieve ourselves of most of those categorical funds over the last 4 years, and many have. The dilemma is those stakeholder groups still do exist, those students still have needs, and for the most part, in fact, in Central at least, we maintained every single program despite the fact the flexibility was taken.
Okay, well, Mary Jane, I want to ask you about universal preschool for four-year-olds. First of all, do you think that's a good idea? And second, do you think some of this money should be spent on universal pre-K? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, overall, I would say that especially from what we see happening with our students, particularly our low-income students and our English learner students, that they're not coming to school, kindergarten, really prepared to begin to even engage in kindergarten, and they really begin to fall behind. We're really condemning five-year-old children to begin to fall behind.
What is it? I think I read a statistic that said something like, you'll know by the fourth grade if someone's going to graduate from high school. Is it third grade? Third grade, so pretty early on.
Mm-hmm. And we see that a lot, particularly with these subgroups of students that this money is to serve. So overall, I would say, yes, it's definitely an important investment that we need to make as a community to make sure that we're providing as many early learning opportunities for our students, particularly since we see how it not only hurts them academically, but also socio-emotionally and their ability to kind of engage as productive citizens in our community. But also, I would say that whether or not these funds should be used for that, I think that that's still an important conversation that we need to have in this community. I think that we need to make sure that part of these funds are being used in that investment. But we also have a lot of students who are already in the system, in the K through 12 system, who really need some interventions right now, and our young people who are struggling in both elementary, middle school, and high school. And we need to make sure that we're doubling down on those investments. So really, when we could see this, should we do one or the other? That's sort of a bad question, situation for us to put ourselves in as a community. What we really need to do, especially in communities like Fresno or where Central Unified is serving, we need to double down on both those investments. We need to begin to help our youngest children make sure that they are ready to succeed, and also help them turn things around for those of our older students who are struggling.
Yeah, but budgets are always about priorities. And so if you've got an X amount of money, you've got to decide where you're going to spend it. So, Ruth, my understanding is that Fresno Unified already does some pre-K work. What are your thoughts on using some of this money to pay for it?
Right. Well, the Board of Education made a commitment when the voters of California approved Proposition 30 in November of 2012. As Mike Berg pointed out, Fresno Unified was fortunate enough not to have to take some of the severe reductions that other California school districts had to take over the past 5 or 6 years. So we were really in a position with Prop 30 to start reinvesting in educational programs for students. And one of the actions that the board took was to double preschool enrollment from 40% in our district to approximately 80% in our district over the course of the next couple of years. I'm happy to report that we have about 65% participation of all four-year-olds in Fresno Unified, and that was done before the local control funding formula resources were even received. I do believe that universal preschool is a great idea and something that our board would support. We have added transitional kindergarten classrooms as well at every elementary school in Fresno Unified. So early learning is the key. Kindergarten readiness is the key to third grade proficiency in reading, which is the statistic that you mentioned when you asked this question. Right. Of course, there also does have to be a balance of interventions and programs that will assist with students who may have fallen behind or who just need some additional social emotional support as they move through their middle years and high school years. We've got to keep our students in school and on track to graduate. And so it is going to be a balance of those investments, as Mary Jane said, across the board.
You know, we've only got a few minutes left. I want to give each of you a little time to talk about this last question, and that is, how are we going to determine, how do you think it would be appropriate to determine whether or not this has been a good investment, this extra money, and do you think that this extra money is going to close the achievement gap that separates Latino and Black students from their white and Asian classmates? Mike Berg with Central Unified, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there are a number of measures where we can be compared to one another and yet simply compare ourselves to our own commitments to our community. And the LCAP, the Local Control Accountability Plan, is the first and best. We are going to declare for our communities and our stakeholders and our boards of education the kinds of things we know and we recommend that will be most effective for our students, for our teachers, for our community at large. And so many of us talk about a dashboard indicator at the end of the day. We talk about those key indicators that suggest that we are or are not being effective. And usually people look at test scores. Test scores are one component part. There are things like attendance, graduation rates, student retention rates, student participation rates in co-curricular, and suspension expulsion rates as very, very critical reads to the kind of success we're having. And so we're looking forward to implementing the programs we're talking about and the success rates we expect to see.
You know, Mary Jane, I want to ask you, I mean, what do you think about the bottom line here? Do you think it's going to close the achievement gap between Latinos and Black students and their white and Asian classmates?
Yeah, I think that's up to all of us as a community working together, kind of to the, what we brought up at the very, very beginning. With this local control is the local responsibility, and I think that those measurements are going to be really, really critical. I think that we need to make sure that the districts are providing that information that is clear and that is easily accessible. I would encourage it to be available in multiple languages on a website, which is updated quarterly, if not in real time for the districts who have that capability. And we really need to see that information on all the sort of dashboards board indicators related to important measurements such as how many hours of instructional time or additional instructional time are these particular subgroups getting? How are we measuring school discipline? Is it suspensions and expulsions as well as in-school suspensions? And how are we measuring how students are engaged at school? Are we measuring their attendance in real time? And are we also looking at their engagement in arts, athletics, and other activities? And those need to be broken down and their public availability by subgroups for English language learners, the students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch, and our foster youth, as well as by school site, so that we can really empower neighborhoods and the folks serving those neighborhoods to really figure out what is going on with the students and is this really making a difference. But I do think the proof is going to be in the pudding. We have to carefully monitor these numbers. We have to make sure that we are all agreeing on what success is and how it will be measured. And then we have to hold ourselves accountable. And again, the primary responsibility for that relies on the district to get that information, get that knowledge in the hands of both students, parents, and partners to make sure that we are all engaged in supporting our teachers to make sure these students succeed.
Well, boy, that was a lot, Mary Jane. She fits a lot in a very short period of time, but I want to ask, we only got about a minute left, I want to ask Ruth and Eva and get their input on this as well. I mean, how do we know this has been a good investment, and is it going to close the achievement gap? What do you think, Ruth?
Well, I would agree with what Mike Burke said. There are a variety of measures. Student achievement is an important measure, and closing the achievement gap is obviously a focus. But it's not just about a test score. It's also about student growth. It's about persistence. Are we keeping kids in school? It's also about the school's climate and the culture and the engagement in arts, activities, athletics, extracurriculars. Those are important measures, as Mr. Burke said, that we have made available, and not only available, but we've made a commitment to our community, and we need to follow through with that commitment. So I do agree that that achievement gap is important. It's not just racial, though. I would also say there are other subgroups that we need to pay attention to, and I think we have the ability to do that with these resources.
Okay, Eva, unfortunately, we've got just a few seconds left. I want to give you a chance to weigh in. So not just test scores?
Certainly not just test scores. It starts with indicators of increased graduation rates, increased parent and community participation in our schools, campuses that are safe learning environments, and promote cultural inclusivity for all stakeholders. Those will be key indicators of this program's success.
Well, thank you very much. Eva Ruiz, president with the Fresno Teachers Association. We also had Ruth Kinto, the deputy superintendent and chief financial officer for Fresno Unified School District, Mary Jane Skellerup, the senior director of programs at the Youth Leadership Institute, and Central Unified Superintendent Mike Berg. Thanks all of them for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.